Hello everyone, and welcome to Advanced Engineering Talks, a podcast created by the Advanced Engineering team. ATalks brings together some of the newest and most innovative minds in engineering and manufacturing to help better the future for our industry. We hope you enjoy the series.
Okay, hello and welcome everyone. I'm once again delighted to bring you to another Advanced Engineering Talks podcast where innovation never sleeps. My guest today is a true serial innovator and entrepreneur who is very familiar with the concept of pushing boundaries and the implications of taking risk in its many forms. With two world land speed records under his belt as driver and project director, respectively, he has recently published a book entitled Take Risk and is now behind Thrust WSH, this time with a view to breaking records on water. He is, of course, Richard Noble, OBE. Richard, thank you for joining us. It's wonderful to have you.
Jeremy, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, you've been inspirational, of course, for many people to challenge themselves in their engineering careers and their lives overall, actually. I mean, who or what inspired you to take on the challenges we know you so well for, and what continues to drive you?
Well, basically, when I was a kid of six, way back in 1952, my dad took us for a drive around Loch Ness, north side of Loch Ness, and there we saw John Cobb's jet boat Crusader. I never saw it run, but yeah. I saw it and I thought, wow, this is for me. And something clicked at that point, and ever since then, I thought that I got to have a go at this. And it is the most stimulating career you can imagine, because you're creating, you're innovating, you're pushing the boundaries, you're having an opportunity to drive a car at nearly the speed of sound. It's a huge experience.
Yeah. I can imagine. And obviously, now you yourself, having done land speed records, are now working with Thrust WSH, which is taking the challenge onto water. How does this compare with your challenges that you had on land with the Thrust and Bloodhound projects, for example?
Well, we're just beginning to understand a little bit about it, Jeremy.
Yeah.
So basically, with the Thrust projects, the Thrust 2 car was fairly conventional. That was a car with a wheel at each, four wheels on each, and a wheel at each corner, and a bloody great jet engine down the middle. Thrust SSC was completely different. That was the result of rocket testing and computational fluid dynamics. The first time, actually, fluid dynamics had ever been used on a car, any kind of car. So we were about 10
really?
Years ahead of Formula One. Yeah. And that worked really well indeed. And now we're moving on to the water speed record. This is very interesting because it is incredibly difficult. It's seriously difficult. A lot of the technology just isn't there. We've got to create, and we are innovators. So it's very, very attractive. It also has a terrible reputation for accidents and fatalities. But that was because people just did not have the technology which we have today. So we're using the technology to make this thing safe. And it's going to run to about 450 miles an hour. We've got small models running at 100 miles an hour now. And we get the 200 mile an hour model later on this year. So we're learning an awful lot. And of course, the other thing is we've got AI, which is great. So we can take the data, the hydrodynamics data, which is all being done by our friends at Kinetic, the aero data, which is being done at Imperial College and also at Leeds University, together with data from the models, put it all together, aggregate the whole lot, and then put it through AI in order to get the optimum solution. So this is really interesting, and we're not quite sure what it's going to look like, but it's going to be fascinating.
Wow, yeah, that sounds incredible. And I think you're working amongst other partners with PRF Composites as well. Are materials, composite materials, pretty important in that regard for you?
Oh, absolutely. See, the thing about it is that when we started with it was 2 years ago with the first jet models, we discovered that the weight relationship to the model is absolutely crucial. So these boats have to be very, very light. They've got to, of course, be very strong, otherwise they'll break up. But they've got to be very light. And so composites is absolutely essential to all this. But in terms of the composites, we haven't got there yet. we're still working away with the models and so on, but composites come in next year.
Right. And is it too early to say at the moment, or do you have a certain timeline for when you want to really be ready to, you know, try for the record?
We've got a long, long way to go.
Yeah.
Basically, by December, we'll have the 220 mile an hour model, but will it work? We don't know. We hope it works, but we've probably got a long program to get it to work, to really understand it. And once we've got all that data together from all those different sources and got a solution to this whole thing, then we can announce the project to move ahead. That would then give us about a year in which to build the boat, and that would see us probably operational in 2025. But don't hold your breath in this game. It takes a long, long time to get it right.
I know you've said in the past, in terms of education, I think that's been a sort of discovered passion during the projects that you've done over the years, Richard. You know, we know there's a big skills gap issue, of course. What kind of benefits have you seen in doing this with going into schools? And are you planning to do something similar with current projects?
Oh, absolutely we are. But the story goes back to the MOD, the Ministry of Defence, and Lord Drayson. And Andy Green and I had a session, were lucky enough to have a meeting with Lord Drayson to we wanted to separate him from some jet engines. That was the general idea. We didn't do very well, but we had a good meeting. And at the end of the meeting, Drayson then suddenly said, we've got a real problem in the Ministry of Defence. We're having real trouble recruiting because the quality is so poor. And it's an educational problem. And he went on to say that during the Concorde project, way back in the 1960s, they didn't have that sort of problem because basically the Concorde program got everybody in the country so excited. A lot of the kids wanted to become engineers. So he said, what I want you to do is to take your project and run it through every single school in the country. So we set this thing up and it became absolutely enormous. We were moving about 127,000 kids per annum and it was being followed in 200 countries. So, you know, you've got a very, at the start of a program like this, I mean, of course, you're doing something like this because it's fascinating, it's a challenge, it's really interesting. And from the sponsor's point of view, it pays them back in a big, big way for what they give us and the support they give us. But it's really interesting. In the old days of the land speed record and the water speed record, why was it being done? Well, it was being done largely as a vanity project for the drivers. They're making them very, very famous, and they had a very fine standard of living, and et cetera, as a result of this, taking risk on a time from time to time. But we realized the benefit from all this is education, because, you see, the interesting thing is we can share the project. We're not worried about intellectual property. We're not worried about competition or anything like that. Let's share it so that they can understand what's going on. And this became a huge program. Unfortunately, our Bloodhound project got lost because the government failed to pay on a grant, which was an awful situation. But by that time, we were generating huge interest in the schools, and we ran the Bloodhound car at Newquay Airport in 2017. And the fascinating thing is, we had 10,000 people come to watch it run. It was absolutely amazing. And they paid too, even better. And on the famous day, the third day of the event, we had the education day and we had 300 children on site. It was hugely impressive. And we began to realize that this is the real benefit of it. It's not about this personal vanity business. It's actually about education. We've got something that excites the kids, where they share the education, and we're going to learn a lot.
And so are they.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
Absolutely. And how far back do you think, you know, this sort of education can go? Right back to primary school level, which is where we should start, really, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, right back to primary school level. And for instance, during the Bloodhound program there, we made 15,000 rocket cars. Or rather, the kids made 15,000 rocket cars. And it just shows what can be done there. And we'll be doing rocket boats and so on in due course.
Fantastic. That's really exciting. So it's great to see that that's carrying on with the Thrust WSH project as well. I mean, in terms of take risk as well, and the title of your book is Take Risk. Do you feel that we're a little bit more risk averse in general these days in terms of comparing to the past?
Well, it's just an enormous problem, and I can't understand really why this should happen. But this was a country that took considerable risk and created all sorts of things, including the nuclear bomb when the Americans decided they weren't going to give us all the data. It's absolutely amazing country. But unfortunately, something's gone wrong. So everybody plays safe. And if everybody plays safe, then, of course, the country goes bust. That's why, because basically the only way you make really serious money is to innovate and create something new and charge for it. If you're doing the same old thing, then the only thing that's going to happen there is that you're going to have to discount on prices and eventually your margin goes. So, that's the problem. And so I don't know whether it's the lawyers or the bankers or whoever it is has put this thing together, but it's a big, big mistake. And it's a fascinating world out there. But the other thing which is so important is basically understanding how innovation works. Now, we've had various governments telling everybody they've got to innovate. But these are people who couldn't innovate themselves out of a garage. I mean, you can't innovate just by switching a switch. You've got to have the culture. You've got to structure your organization in such a way that it does understand innovation. You've got to take risks. You've got to learn. And the thing about our record-breaking program is that we've been doing this for years. We've been doing airplanes, we've been doing ships, we've been doing, helped JCB with their JCB wheel-driven car. And you learn from all this, and after a bit, you get to a point where you got a sort of an understanding, a personal understanding, which means that you've got a fair idea of what will work and what won't work. The important thing, of course, is to be able not to do the stuff that won't work, that you think won't work. So you've got to take the risk and go with the stuff that the activities which you think basically are achievable, and make sure you get them right.
So sometimes you need to fail early, don't you, as well, and learn from that and move on quickly.
Well, failing is terribly expensive, so you don't want to fail. If you're fail at the early stage of the project when it doesn't cost so much,
exactly,
but certainly not at the end.
You feel that the hierarchy of an organization can get in the way of that a bit, and more of a flat level organization helps that way.
Jeremy, I'm glad you asked that. I really do. I used to teach management years ago for the Americans, and there I came across the work of Abraham Maslow. And he really understood this, basically how you get an organization set up in such a way that people really find out who they are and what they're capable of doing. It's called self-actualization. It's the top of the hierarchical pyramid, of the hierarchy of needs pyramid. Now, the interesting thing is that in a conventional organization designed to make money and to make profit, you've got a real problem there, because people just do not innovate. And so the number of times I've been presenting our projects to main boards, and you know jolly well that what you're offering and proposing will work really well, but they don't. And there's a real problem, because they've never innovated in their lives. And when you've worked your way up to the top of the organization, which is largely political anyhow, by the time you've worked your way up to the top of the organization, basically, you've probably never innovated, and this is not the time to try. So no innovation. That's your problem.
Yeah. And how do you recruit people in your organization? In fact, I'm not sure that you do recruit. They often come to you. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Yes, we never recruit. They just come. And it's a wonderful thing, Jeremy, because when they come, basically, they know what they're joining. They know what they're capable of doing, and they know what they're capable of contributing. And that's absolutely brilliant. So they're, if you like, they're self-selecting, and it's absolutely super. It works very well indeed.
And what sort of walks of life do they come from? Do they not necessarily come from university, but they might come from other walks of life?
Yes, I mean, basically, it's got to relate entirely to the project.
Yeah.
So, for instance, in our program here, we're going through a huge program on risk aversion, and so we're very fortunate. We've just been joined by a gentleman who's going to help us through this program, because it's very important from the sponsor's point of view to know that we've addressed all the risks and all the hazards.
Yeah.
It's very wide-ranging. And then, of course, the other thing, too, with the boat project is we've got to find somewhere to run. We need 8 miles. It's a fascinating boat because it's going to go 450 miles an hour, which is really something. And we need 8 miles. So we've got to have a look at a lot of the Scottish lochs, I think.
Right. So you've got some candidates there up in Scotland at the moment. That would be likely area, would it?
I think it would, yes. We've only done the desk research, we're starting now to actually look at the actual waters there and the conditions of the waters and the depth and everything. We're beginning to realise what we need, which is largely a fairly shallow loch or lake with sloping sides, not vertical sides, very sloping, very sort of beach-like sides to it, so that any wash or anything then gets lost effectively on the shingle.
Right. And of course, with water as opposed to land, you've got a dynamic surface, which it must be another challenge that you have to look at here.
It certainly is. The fundamental problem with the boats of the past is that they are what's called hydroplanes. In other words, this is a boat which is a bit like a slipper, which sort of zips across the surface of the water and is therefore very affected by the waves. The fundamental problem is twofold. One is, as the thing goes faster, the boat goes faster and faster, so it develops lift over the top of the boat, which is trying to lift it up. And also the air going in at the front can get trapped underneath, and so you get high pressure building up underneath. And that increases the square of the speed. So there are considerable pressures on the boat to fly. And we've seen and quite a few of these awful accidents, and they still have them in America with the circuit races where the boats flip and fly. The fundamental thing is we've discovered that you only need a small increase in the angle of attack, like 1.5 or 2 degrees, and the thing will fly. So there's no point in building a boat that'll do that, unless you can control the bow. If you've got a method of controlling the bow, then basically you're going to be reasonably all right. So we're going to see.
Interesting. Yes, dangerous. It's a dangerous game, isn't it? Potentially, if you don't know what you're doing. But we've learnt a lot, or you've learnt a lot since Cobb, of course. And that's what it's all about.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that if we've got this right, then we could end up with a situation like the Thrust SSC car, the first car through the sound barrier, where we can just take it out every day and drive it through the sound barrier. In other words, we got it absolutely right, and we got it done well.
Yes, and you can just do it quite easily every day, use it again. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think we've talked around so much of what you've been doing, and it sounds absolutely fascinating. You are going to be having a presence alongside PRF Composites, actually, on the show floor at the Advanced Engineering Show this November 1st and 2nd at the NEC. So you'll have a nice rendition of the craft, I think. And I think people will be really fascinated to have a look at that.
It's being painted, so it's going to look marvelous. It's a big one, 10 foot.
10 foot, fantastic. Yeah, no, I think that'll look great. That'll look great. So thank you for bringing that as well, and thank you for coming over and doing a presentation as well, which you'll be doing in the program, which is great. But I it's been wonderful talking to you, Richard, and look forward to seeing you at the show. Thanks again, Richard Noble, OBE. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Jeremy. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you.